6 after 9, good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. Mild traumatic brain injury, more commonly known as concussion, has been called the signature wound of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And yet thousands of these injuries go undiagnosed and untreated by military doctors. These injured soldiers receive little or no treatment for lingering health problems. This topic has been the subject of a four-month investigation by ProPublica's T. Christian Miller and NPR's Daniel Zwerdling, who joins us by phone this morning. Daniel Zwerdling, thanks for joining us.
John, thanks for having me.
Well, how did you first become aware of this issue?
Well, I've been following mental health issues among troops for some years now. Back in 2006, I wrote a series of stories showing that soldiers at one of the major Army bases, Fort Carson in Colorado, were coming back from the war with serious mental health problems like severe depression or PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And number one, they were finding it, in many cases, almost impossible to get help. You know, they would go to the mental health clinic and say, I'm falling apart. I need to see somebody. And they would get a slip saying, come back in 3 months. Seriously, literally. And even worse than that, when the command structure, when the officers found out that they were having these mental health problems, the officers were hazing them, harassing them, punishing them, and in many cases, kicking them out of the Army because they were having these mental health problems from the war. And as I was doing those stories, I started to discover that there was a whole another also very, very serious problem soldiers were facing, and that is that soldiers who had been in explosions were having these very troubling, almost mysterious cognitive problems, where here were people who used, you know, who led platoons, they led tank convoys, they made, you know, instant snap strategic decisions affecting life and death in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they were coming home, and like Brendan Sanford, who I interviewed recently in Texas, he can't help his 10-year-old son with his homework anymore because he just can't wrap his brain around the information. Or I interviewed Derek Youngie recently in Tennessee. He used to be a B-2 mechanic. You know, that's one of the most complex pieces of machinery on Earth, the bomber. Well, now he was in the middle of building a simple treehouse for his kids, and there were, you know, these rough planks of wood going up the tree that was going to be the ladder. And then there's nothing more. He can't wrap his brain around how to build a simple treehouse. So these are people who've been in explosions, and they've suffered long-lasting, perhaps permanent, brain damage, and their whole lives and their families' lives are turning upside down. So I started doing a lot of reading about it, and I found that starting a few years ago, top officials of the Pentagon and the top officials in the U.S. government started saying, traumatic brain injury, this is a big deal. We're going to, you know, Congress voted hundreds of millions of dollars to research it and treat it. They said, we're going to do everything we can to deal with it. So I wanted to find out with T. Christian Miller of ProPublica, so what's really happening? You know, how is the rhetoric filtering down to the ground level? And that's how we started this investigation.
Well, what has been, what's the big difference between current conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan and earlier wars in terms of brain injuries?
Well, here's one of the most striking things that I found. As we started interviewing people at the Pentagon and elsewhere in the government, they often would say to us, you know, we're dealing with a new problem here. These traumatic brain injuries are something we haven't experienced before. Well, we started looking into it, and we found out that that is not true. For decades, researchers in other countries have known quite a bit, and they've done quite a bit of work on these traumatic brain injuries. I talked to an Israeli who set up a program in the 1970s in Israel to treat young men who had been in the war with Egypt, precisely because they had no visible wounds, they weren't bleeding, they had no broken bones, but they had these puzzling brain problems that echoed, you know, elderly people with dementia, and that was traumatic brain injury from explosions. And when I said to him, so what do I make of all these people in the U.S. Government and military who are saying to us, well, this is a new problem? He said, well, they think it's new because I've been trying to tell them about this for almost 40 years now, and they won't listen to me. What is new, this is new, what is new is the number of people who are surviving who would have been killed in previous wars. You know, now, in many cases, the armor is good enough. And the battlefield medicine is good enough, and that's probably the bigger factor. The battlefield medicine is good enough that people who would have died from other injuries are now surviving, and in addition to the visible injuries that they would have died of, like horrible bleeding and that sort of thing, they also, some of them, have had these concussions, these so-called mild traumatic brain injuries, and so perhaps they're seeing bigger numbers, which raises the question, so how many troops have been affected by these traumatic brain injuries? The Pentagon's official numbers say that it's 115,000, 115,000. Our investigation showed that, in fact, that number is way, way higher, and many researchers think the number is as high as 400,000. Now, that doesn't mean there are 400,000 troops going around the U.S. who have persistent brain problems, because studies have also shown that most people who get these traumatic brain injuries recover spontaneously in a few days or a few weeks. But, and this is the big but, and this is the heartbreaking but, John, studies also suggest that around 10-15%, nobody knows exactly how many, but somewhere in that percentage range do not get better. They have persistent problems that can last for many years or forever. And when you multiply that 5 or 10 or 15% times 400,000, well, that's a huge number. And that means that tens of thousands of young men and women are out there across the United States right now who, in many cases, are acting like 93-year-old people, you know, who just can't think right anymore.
What's the reason for the resistance to taking this problem on and doing something about it? I mean, it seems like there's a real institutional inertia involved here.
Well, top officials of the Pentagon would be very upset with you for phrasing your question that way. I'm not, but
they'd have to take a number.
It's a very confused picture. At the national level, there are all kinds of very impressive things or impressive-sounding things happening. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, Congress has voted hundreds of millions of dollars to study and treat traumatic brain injury. Just weeks ago, the Pentagon opened this gleaming new building on the campus of the Bethesda Naval Medical Center. It's called the National Intrepid Center of Excellence. NICO is the nickname, and it's supposed to be a state-of-the-art center to study and deal with traumatic brain injury and also PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And the military recently announced a number of policies which are saying to commanders in Afghanistan and Iraq, hey, you know, we're going to give you very tough rules so that if anybody is in an explosion, you have to do A, B, and C to make sure that they are checked out and protected. So on the national level, all this sounds very good. The problem is when T. Miller and I looked at what is actually happening in the field, we found that it's a very different picture. There have been policies for years about TBI. It's not as though the Pentagon just announced new policies some weeks ago that, you know, they never had before. These policies are just an incremental change in what was already in the field, and what we found is that the policies in the field that have been there for years are routinely violated, perhaps violated more than they're followed. For example, the medics and doctors are supposed to, you know, diagnose traumatic brain injuries in the field. Our evidence suggested that a huge number, possibly most, of the traumatic brain injuries in Iraq and Afghanistan are never diagnosed, period. Number two, we found that even the our Army researchers confirmed this to us. Number two, even when doctors do diagnose concussions or mild traumatic brain injuries, whatever you want to call it, and we should get into the terminology in a moment perhaps, even when they do diagnose these problems, usually it's not recorded in the military's medical system. So why is that important? Okay, well, the first thing that's important is that when you get a mild traumatic brain injury, neuropsychological experts, brain specialists, say it's crucial that you start getting the proper treatment as soon as possible. People who have persistent problems from TBI, if you go to certain kinds of rehab that are called cognitive rehabilitation, you teach the person to compensate for their brain injury. So if you can't remember anything well anymore, they teach you new methods to remember. You know, how to use PDAs, If you can't multitask, they teach you new ways to try to deal with different tasks. They basically retrain your brain, and they say the sooner you get that training, the more the chance is that you'll overcome your disabilities. So if you don't get diagnosed in the field, first of all, that means you're going to go months and possibly years without getting proper treatment. When you then have a chance to get spotted when you come back to the United States, but if there's nothing in your medical record that says you were in an explosion and suffered a mild traumatic brain injury, when you go to your commander and you say, "Sir, I can't understand the instructions anymore. I just can't do my job anymore," and I think, "Gee, maybe it had to do with that explosion." Well, then the commander or the doctor says, "What explosion? There's no record of an explosion. There's no record you were ever injured." And so people in the Army have told us that frequently these people who come forward, who have the courage to come forward, are sort of sloughed off as whiners. And they say, "Get over it or you'll be in trouble."
I read an article in The Nation magazine about a soldier who was discharged for having had a personality disorder that was some sort of pre-existing condition, when in fact he had been involved in an explosion related to a mortar attack. Is that the common way that the military uses to, we're not going to take care of these people in some cases? It seems like they just... there's a bias there that, well, let's just get rid of them and let's make sure we don't have to pay for them later.
Well, when I first started doing this reporting in 2006, I did find, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, that frequently soldiers who were not performing up to snuff and who acknowledged, "I am having terrible problems," that they were often drummed out of the military, not so often on personality disorder, much more often on what's called patterns of misconduct. In other words, "How come you don't have your shoes shined perfectly every morning, John? How come you were late to formation? How come you didn't follow instructions properly?" "Well, you say it's because, I don't know, I messed up, and it turns out you have PTSD or you have TBI." And the commander says, "No, it's because you're a blank bag soldier." So that has been used quite a bit. I think the problem is somewhat improved since I first wrote about it in 2006, but that certainly is still a problem. And actually, at Fort Bliss, T. Miller and I spent a lot of time interviewing soldiers at Fort Bliss and talking to doctors and commanders there, often on background because they were afraid they would damage their careers by speaking out. But we did talk to a couple of soldiers who've had terrible problems with their command and have been punished over and over again, and sure enough, they had traumatic brain injuries and PTSD. And the symptoms of PTSD and traumatic brain injury overlap quite a bit. And military officials lately, I think, have been confusing the picture by trying to make it seem as though it's very difficult to distinguish them from each other. In fact, it does take some finesse. It takes trained physicians, trained specialists to distinguish different kinds of disorders. But it's not like rocket science. And there is no question. I mean, there are decades and decades of research now showing that people who have these blast injuries suffer cognitive problems which are, very different than other disorders. Nathan Scheller, I just talked to him in Pennsylvania, and his wife Miriam. Miriam said, since he's come back from his and he was in several explosions in Iraq, she said, since he comes back, he not only can't read much anymore, he used to devour novels, Moby Dick, The Count of Monte Cristo. Now he tries to read a page and he can't remember what he read. And she says he says the same things over and over again. Like if you talk with him for 20 minutes, and I had this experience, he'll tell the same story over and over again using almost exactly the same words, almost like an elderly person with beginning dementia. So these are very real and different problems when you have traumatic brain injury. And in order to visualize why this would happen, let me just tell you what happens when you're in a blast. So, John, let's say you're in the Humvee, right? And suddenly, 20 feet away, an IED goes off. The blast wave, and I've seen a movie of this, you can actually see the shock wave go through the ground, like a giant serpent rippling through the sand. The blast wave can go through metal. It goes through helmets. It goes through your skull. It goes through your brain, and it damages the cells and the brain's circuits in ways that researchers still don't completely understand. And it's almost as that one researcher said to me, it's almost as though you have a conductor with lots conducting an it's almost as though you have an orchestra with lots of different parts, like your brain. You know, there's reading, there's memorizing, there's visual stuff, hearing, but you don't have a conductor anymore, so they don't know how to communicate with each other anymore. So instead of having a coordinated brain functioning or a coordinated orchestra functioning, you just have this big dissonant mess.
We need to take a quick break and then come back and see if callers want to join and talk about this topic. Here is the phone number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also leave comments on Kathleen Dunn's Facebook fan page, and we'll try and get those on the air as well. Talking with NPR reporter Daniel Zwerdling, who's at his desk, so at some point during the hour we may hear the sounds of a busy newsroom behind him. But Daniel Zwerdling, who along with ProPublica's T. Christian Miller, conducted a four-month investigation into the military's handling of mild traumatic brain injuries, concussions, and their aftermath. And wondering what you think about this. Maybe you have some experience in this regard. Are you someone who has come back from service in Iraq or Afghanistan and had problems with this and had difficulties getting the military to help you? We'll talk about that. We'll take your questions and thoughts as we go through the program. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. Coming up on 24 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Coming up a little bit later on today on Talk of the Nation, after 1, the political junkie Ken Rudin joins guest host Tony Cox for a look at the week in politics, including two Democrats facing ethics charges. That's after 1 o'clock today on Talk of the Nation here on the Ideas Network of WPR. This hour, we're talking about traumatic brain injuries, mild traumatic brain injuries, more commonly known as concussions, which have become the signature wound of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And my guest is Daniel Zwerdling, who is a reporter for NPR and a longtime reporter for NPR, who, along with ProPublica's T. Christian Miller, conducted an extensive investigation into the military's handling of these injuries and found some things that, well, just what we've talked about so far have been quite shocking to me. Daniel Zwerdling, when you look, for example, at the National Football League, boy, if somebody gets a concussion, I mean, they're all over it. You can't play until you've been cleared by a doctor. I mean, they really jump on this, and athletes get these kinds of injuries all the time, and there's quite a bit of attention paid to it and a lot of hand-wringing and so forth. I mean, I guess maybe I'm just a little dense here, but it seems to me that in a combat situation, the level of violence would be assumed to be quite a bit greater than what happens on a football field. And yet we seemingly pay less attention to head injuries for soldiers than we do millionaire football players.
Well, this is sort of one of the troubling and paradoxical things. The football league did not pay enough attention, actually, to concussions until very recently. There was a series of scandals. You know, they would take the guy out, you know, he'd rest for 10 minutes and then send him back out. But research on civilians and on football players has shown fairly recently that people who had concussions had a much higher rate as in the years to come of all kinds of problems, including early onset dementia. And so now, because of public pressure and pressure from the public health world, the football folks have started to take this much more seriously, but just just recently. Now, one thing that's also started to happen on the military side, it used to be that, in fact, I had an extraordinary talk with a top medical person in the Army, General Schoomaker. He's called the Surgeon General. And I talked to a number of people in the military who said that they were very troubled because when he talks to them about mild traumatic brain injury in private, he in their view, he tends to belittle it and say it's not such a big deal. And he frequently tells this story, and he tells this sometime in speeches too, about how he used to play rugby, and he got a concussion. He broke his nose, and part of his jaw, I think, was broken, or his cheekbones. And he tells people, I got over it. And in public, he sort of tells the story straight, but several people told me privately that when he tells it in more private circles, he says it in what they consider a dismissive way, as in, what's the big deal? You know, I had a concussion. I got over it. Now, when I interviewed him about this on the record, he denied that he was making light of it, but the sources I've talked to, you know, stand by their stories. And there has been an attitude in the military, throughout the military, at all levels, from sergeants, you know, from low-level enlistees up to generals, that's exactly like that. You know, well, a lot of people get concussions, so get over it. In fact, research has shown two things. First of all, concussions, even concussions on football fields, are much more serious than people used to think. Second of all, the concussions you get from a blast wave seem to be much more complicated and much more serious in some ways than the ones you get on a football field. So studies are showing that in many ways, that these so-called concussions or mild traumatic brain injuries are a much bigger problem than people used to think. Although, as I said, you know, researchers in Israel have known about this for decades. Now, one thing I want to make clear is that the whole term mild traumatic brain injury, a lot of brain specialists I've talked with say that is a very, very misleading term. The term mild does not mean what it means to you and me, John. It doesn't mean, oh, it's not a big deal. The term mild and moderate and severe when it comes to traumatic brain injury only has to do with the number of minutes you were knocked out or lost consciousness or were dazed. And if you lost consciousness less than a certain number of minutes, they say you have mild. Or if you were dazed less than 30 minutes, it's mild. If it was more, it was, you know, that. So it refers to a clock. But neurological researchers stress that people who have so-called mild traumatic brain injury sometimes have even more serious cognitive problems than people with so-called moderate traumatic brain injury or even severe traumatic brain injury.
Well, when I first saw the term mild traumatic brain injury, I have to admit I thought it was an oxymoron. I mean, you know,
you're not the only one.
Well, good. I'm glad to know that. It just seems to me, I mean, the word traumatic and the word mild really ought not to be next to one another.
And actually, there's a new spin going on. Some top officials in the Pentagon have started spinning this issue. And in the view of many researchers I've talked with, they're confusing the issue even more and trying to downplay the seriousness of traumatic brain injury. In medical circles, the term concussion and mild traumatic brain injury have been considered synonymous for many years. But people in the military who aren't even doctors have been testifying before Congress recently and giving speeches and interviews. And what they're now saying is something very new, which has almost no medical justification. They're saying that, well, concussion is when you get one injury. So, like, if you bump your head once on the football field or if you're in one explosion, that's a concussion. If you have multiple concussions, then you might get mild traumatic brain injury. And the reason they're making that argument is because there have been huge numbers of troops who've been in one explosion. I mean, there have also been huge numbers who've been in multiple explosions. I talked to one guy William Frost at Fort Bliss in Texas. He said he used to keep track of the IEDs with a grease mark on his windshield of his Humvee, and he said at 10, I just stopped making the marks. But anyway, but there still are lots of troops who've been in one explosion, and some researchers fear that the reason the Pentagon is trying to make this distinction is because if you say, well, one explosion is not so bad, that's just a concussion, but if you're in multiple explosions, then you have mild traumatic brain injury, that sounds more serious, it starts to lessen the number of people who, you know, the public will think are affected by this issue. And you know what, John, you asked me a question a few minutes ago, which I never answered, and I hate that when I interview people and they don't answer. You said, so why aren't people in the military taking this more seriously? And I said it was complicated. But let me just quickly say that the reason so many people in the military, not everybody, but the reason so many people in the military aren't doing enough about traumatic brain injury is for several reasons. Number one, This sounds crazy, but many doctors in Iraq and Afghanistan have never been trained in how to diagnose traumatic brain injury. You know, they were pediatricians back in Missouri, or they were, you know, foot doctors, or they were family practitioners. You know, and they dealt with, you know, concussions when a kid fell off a scooter, but they don't know anything about blast injuries. And people in the military have acknowledged this to me. Number two, there still are a lot of commanders in the military who do not believe that a mild traumatic brain injury is serious. And I can't tell you how many people I've talked to in the military who tell me stories, and these are usually people on background who are afraid of speaking out because they're afraid their career will be damaged. But they tell stories about how commanders will, you know, say to them in a room, you know, I don't want to hear any more about mild traumatic brain injury. Tell the troops to get over it. They simply do not believe that this is a serious problem. You know, there's no blood, no broken bones. And so many people have been in explosions, it feels almost, several soldiers have said to me, you know what, I mean, there are so many people who feel befuddled out there, whose memory isn't the way it used to be, you know, who have trouble following instructions. It's like it's ordinary. It's not unusual. And there's a third element, and that's money. Nobody wants to talk about this on the record, but people throughout the military are very worried, and it pops up sometimes in internal documents. They're very worried that if they were to start diagnosing and treating all the people who have persistent brain problems from this, I mean, it could cost a huge amount of money.
Well, that was actually where I wanted to go next, because in everything I've read about this, it seems to me that there are two things that pop up, and listening to you tell us about this morning has just reinforced that. One is there seems to be a real cultural issue. You've got the whole kind of John Wayne He-Man culture of soldiering, which, you know, that kind of confidence and aggressiveness and so forth is important on the battlefield. But that culture, it seems to me, is contributing to this. And the other thing is financial. And that part I really don't understand, because, I don't know, again, maybe I'm just naive, but it seems to me that when we ask young men and women to go and put themselves into harm's way, that there's at least an unspoken contract there that if they get hurt, that we're going to take care of them.
Some of the people who are most outraged and feel strongest about what you've just said are doctors in the military. And again, you won't hear anybody in the military who I've interviewed saying this on the record because, you know, they want to be very careful. But I have talked to doctors, you know, people at fairly high levels, senior people in the military's medical establishment, who just feel outraged and heartbroken because of what you've just put your finger on.
Well, what happened to the Hippocratic Oath? First, do no harm.
Well, you'll have to ask them. I'll tell you a very troubling story. Now, I have not corroborated this. This is a story I just heard yesterday. I talked to a soldier who I've been following. He is getting ready to deploy to Afghanistan. He has been diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury by a senior doctor in the military. When I say to him, how does your brain function now compared to how it functioned before the explosion? Let's say your brain used to be a 10. Where is it now? He said, well, I don't think it's too bad. I think it's a 7. Can you imagine, John, saying to somebody, I think I'm doing fine since the explosion. My brain's a 7. And his wife said, it's a 4. And he whipped his head around and looked and stared at her. And I wasn't sure whether he wanted to punch her or whether he was about to burst into tears. And she started crying. She said, it's true. She said, you know it's true. She said, he is a totally different person since he came back. This man is about to go back to Afghanistan to lead a platoon. He's going to be the platoon leader, okay? Now, he showed me when troops come back from the war, they're supposed to fill out questionnaires called the post-deployment health assessments. Then some months later, they fill out yet another one called the post-deployment health reassessment. And they have a bunch of questions that are supposed to help the medical people spot people who might have traumatic brain injuries with persistent problems. He showed me the ones he filled out. He filled out all the questions that are supposed to raise a big red flag and say, this guy might be in trouble. He says he has never been taken aside for follow-up, ever. And during this interview, he and his wife, I mean, it became almost like a couple's therapy session. You know, they acknowledged that they had never talked about these issues together or with anybody outside the family until this interview. And his wife is sobbing on the couch. He says her whole family's life has changed. You know, he's just not the same man. His brain doesn't work anymore. He forgets everything. He, you know, doesn't function as well. And anyway, so he he's never been referred for follow-up treatment. He called me yesterday to give me a piece of information I had asked him for, and I was about to get off, and he said, "Can I tell you something?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Well, after our interview, I started thinking, you know, I do need help." And I went to the one of the base psychiatrists, and he said, so she gave me some medication which should help me sleep. He gets up in the middle of the night and can't sleep, and that's a common symptom for people with traumatic brain injury, sleep disorder. And I said, well, what about treatment for your cognitive problems? He said, well, she asked me, shouldn't I refer you to the TBI clinic here? And he said, well, I don't want to do anything that might prevent me from being sent back to Afghanistan. And he had explained to us when we chatted with him recently, when T and I were visiting him, that he feels such a sense of commitment to his platoon. He's a platoon leader. And he says he's the only one in his platoon who has battle experience that he just can't bear the thought that he will leave these guys sort of rudderless with a platoon leader who doesn't have experience. And this is common in the military. These, no matter how injured these guys and, you know, women are, they want to be there with their brothers and sisters in Iraq and Afghanistan. So he told the psychiatrist, how about when I get back from my next deployment to Afghanistan, then I'll go to the traumatic brain injury clinic. And he says the psychiatrist said, okay. So again, I'm saying I haven't corroborated this. I haven't talked to the psychiatrist yet. But here, if this story is true and everything else this young man has told me is 100% accurate, here is an Army psychiatrist, you know, with a soldier going to her saying, ma'am, I'm in trouble. My brain doesn't function the same way anymore. I need help. I've been in an explosion. I was diagnosed by a senior medical doctor, by a senior doctor in the Army with traumatic brain injury, and she is allowing him not to go for treatment.
Yeah, it seems to me that ought to be mandatory reporting.
Well, you know, obviously we're going to look into this and see if he'll let us talk to his psychiatrist. I mean, because if that were true, I mean, but we've heard this so many times. I can't tell you how many troops we've talked to who show us their medical records. They show that they answered all the questions right that should raise a giant red flag and say, folks, John's in trouble. And nobody has ever followed up. Or if
people
they follow up,
they
send them to sort of, low-key treatment. Well, they send them to some treatment, but not the right, proper, intensive kind of treatment.
Well, when we come back, we've got an email from Bonnie and Madison on this topic and perhaps some calls. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our discussion about mild traumatic brain injury in the military. A four-month investigation by ProPublica and NPR has uncovered a real problem. And something that needs to be dealt with. And that's one of the things we want to talk about before the end of the hour is what's being done and what perhaps needs to be done to fix the problem. My guest, NPR's Daniel Zwerdling, who has joined us this morning from his news desk. So occasionally you may hear the sounds of a busy newsroom in the background. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 9:41. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Next hour, we're going to talk about how the owner of a barbecue restaurant in Hackensack, New Jersey, was able to conduct diplomacy with representatives of the North Korean government in ways that the U.S. State Department could never even dream of doing. The book is Eating with the Enemy, How I Waged Peace with North Korea from My Barbecue Shack in Hackensack by Bobby Egan and Kurt Pitzer. That's our topic next hour. Okay, this hour we're talking about mild traumatic brain injury, a term that could be an entire hour just by itself, perhaps with physicians and psychiatrists and so forth, to try and gain a better understanding of this. But the real question here is how this is diagnosed and handled among soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. My guest is Daniel Zwerdling, an NPR reporter who has conducted an extensive investigation into this subject, going back several years, actually, along with ProPublica's T. Christian Miller. And wondering what you think. Well, here's an email from Bonnie in Madison, who says, "Thanks so much to Daniel Zwerdling for addressing this issue. I often think of the children of veterans with TBI. I had a brain-injured parent, automobile accident. Brain-injured parents can unwittingly have a lasting harmful impact on their children, from the toddlers to teenagers. People or parents with TBI can be normal one minute and explode in violent anger the next. They often have little emotional control, cannot reason logically, and have what is called rigid thinking. They lose normal inhibitions that keep people from saying cruel, damaging personal things to children and others. This type of injury can affect generations." It's an email from Bonnie in Madison. Well, Daniel Zwerdling, that matches pretty closely with what you found.
Finger right on it. And researchers and doctors who treat people with brain injuries, troops coming back from the war, this is one of the big issues they talked about. When I when T and I were interviewing the soldier in Tennessee recently, and I said to his wife, "So how has all this been affecting you and your kids?" That's when she first broke into tears, and she started talking about the children. You know, how does Brandon Sanford in El Paso, Texas, at Fort Bliss, how does he explain to his 10-year-old why he can't help him with his homework anymore? You know, how does Derek in Tennessee explain to his kids that he hasn't been able to finish the treehouse, even though he used to work on one of the most, you know, complex bombers on Earth? It's very hard to explain to a 5-year-old or 10-year-old. And a wife. When we were talking with Nathan and his wife Miriam in Pennsylvania recently, she started sounding very frustrated. She said, "You know, even I forget, because I can't see that he has a missing leg, or I can't see that his body looks any different." She says, "Even I forget that he has something inside his brain that's wrong. And so when he keeps saying the same thing over and over again, or he keeps forgetting over and over again the simplest things that he was supposed to do, you know, to help the children," she says, "I get frustrated with him and angry sometimes because I forget that he has a brain injury." You know, the whole family gets torn apart.
We have Shirley from Iron Ridge on the phone with us. Shirley, good morning.
Good morning. My son was in the first Gulf War, and he was in a situation where a mortar had come in and killed one of the people sitting right next to him, and then he was hit with a piece of shrapnel that knocked him about 25 feet off the ground. And you wouldn't think that a little piece of shrapnel like that could do that. But since he's been out of the Marines, he is constantly complaining about how his memory just isn't working very well. And when you had just mentioned something about a nasty temper, his temper has been exacerbating big time over time. Now, I'm just wondering, I honestly thought that he should have looked at getting some kind of help right from the get-go. But being a Marine, I'm tough, I'm strong, you know, I really don't need it. But it's very noticeable now. So how long after such an explosion like that happens do these symptoms start showing up?
Well, Shirley, thank you so much for calling, and I'm really sorry to hear about that. Sometimes it can be months before they show up. And, you know, he should go to the VA, to the Department of Veterans Affairs. Do you know, has he gone to the VA and been screened? Because the VA has been saying, "Oh, we are screening everybody to see if they have a traumatic brain injury or PTSD.
I don't believe he has.
And
like I said, it's kind of that Marine mentality. I don't want to be classified as somebody who's got mental problems.
Right, right. This is a common thing. So he should go to the VA and get a screening. And we haven't spent as much time looking into the VA as we have looking at the active duty military system, but we've heard all kinds of complaints about the VA too.
Well, I hope he tries
to get some help.
That was actually where I wanted to go next because, so now the soldier is discharged. They are now a veteran. And they're back in civilian life. What kinds of things are being done to help these individuals?
Well, just like with the active duty military, there are two levels. There's the national policies, and the rhetoric that we hear. And all of those say, you know, the VA is doing everything possible. It's being very aggressive to identify vets who have traumatic brain injury and to help them. But then there's the reality at the VAs, and the reality, there are three answers to that. There are three versions of that reality. And a top-level VA neuropsychologist put it to me this way. He said, it's sort of like the civilian world. There's a very small number of terrific VAs, and there's a small number of terrific hospitals in the civilian world, right? There's a bunch of really awful ones, and then there's a huge number of really mediocre ones. And he said to me, if I had a traumatic brain injury, you know, I would want to go to one of three or four VA centers in the country. So if you happen to live near those VA centers, then you're going to probably be in good hands, and there will be some excellent people to treat you. But if you go to one of the dozens and dozens that are awful, or the hundreds that are mediocre, then things aren't going to be so good for you.
Before we go and take another phone call, I had another question that came up that I wanted to make sure I asked you about. In June, the leader of the military's program to treat brain injuries abruptly stepped down. Why was that?
Well, the official... sorry to laugh. The reason I laughed for a moment is because you would think that that would be a very simple question with a very simple answer, right? We went through all kinds of acrobatics to try to find that out. We had heard for quite a while the General Lori Sutton, that's who it is, she's a general, and she ran the military's campaign to publicize and also deal with traumatic brain injury. She ran the Defense Centers of Excellence, it's called, and it was like this umbrella that was supposed to oversee research into, you know, understanding traumatic brain injury better and the best treatments and to publicize the issue so everyone in the military would be aware of it. And we had heard for a long time that people in the military just thought that she was just not doing a good job at it. They felt she was an ineffective leader, she wasn't focused, that she just wasn't up to the task. On the other hand, and this is probably the more important aspect, even her critics acknowledged that she was in an impossible position. Well, why was she in an impossible position? Because she had very little authority. The folks who make the big decisions about how to deal with traumatic brain injury are at the Pentagon, at the top offices. They're at the, you know, assistant Secretary of Defense level and the Secretary of Defense. And they were taking very little action. And you know, she had the assistant secretary. This is amazing. Listen to this. The Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Issues, who is the top person in charge of all medical issues, you know, under the Secretary of Defense, there have been four people in that position in the past roughly 3 years. It has been a revolving door. I mean, I think we all know how long it takes to get anything done in our own jobs in, you know, 6 months to a year. So imagine that you're the Assistant Secretary of Health over this medical system that affects millions of people in the service. And every 10 or 11 months, you come in and leave and somebody else takes your place. So there's a power vacuum there. So there was no way in the world, even her critics say, that Lori Sutton could have done a good job because she had no direction and nobody, you know, really with clout supporting her. So we were told that she was fired. And then the Pentagon spokesman said, oh, that's not true. She was just reassigned in the course of a normal reassignment. And so we reported that's what they said. And then another press person at the Pentagon called us and said, no, that's a mistake. She was removed because they thought the program needed a new change of direction. And I said, well, in other words, she was fired. And they said, no, that she wasn't fired. And I said, well, you're saying she was removed because they thought she wasn't doing a good job, right? Isn't that being fired? No, it's being reassigned because it needs a change of direction. So that was the Pentagon's lingo.
Thank you, George Orwell.
Yeah, anyway, so, but,
okay,
you know.
Well, let's go back to the phones because Paul in southern Wisconsin, I think, has something important to add here. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you very much for taking my call. My concern as a college professor is to assist these returning veterans to reintegrate into society. I have had experience with two up close, and both have been unable to learn the material that was required. In one case, a student was a computer programmer prior to going into the Army, and he came back and he cannot even use his own calculator
Wow.
to do problems.
Yeah.
He is unfortunately not doing well. I'm still in contact with him. I'm hoping he's going to do better. There are many problems associated with his being reintegrated that all seem to come down to money. He and his wife were in family counseling, and they had a certain number of sessions that they could go through. After those sessions were completed, there was no indication of how to continue these sessions, and of course, if they were to do that, they'd have to pay for them themselves. But the second individual also was a very high-achieving student prior to going into the Air Force, and now he has PTSD, and he is unable even to drive a car. His wife, who is the principal breadwinner, cannot afford to take time off to take him to the clinic in Wisconsin, which could address his problems. And so he has been unable to return to classes.
You know, I feel like you're talking about so many of the husbands and wives we've met. Exact same stories.
Well, my concern is I do not see this matter of having students being reintegrated into society being addressed. This requires special attention at the universities that I am at. And while there is some attention to this, the attention is not in proportion to the problem.
Well, you know, you've said it better than I could. The VA has some programs to try to reintegrate people, but they're, you know, far and few between. And there's a very interesting program in California. It's a community college system called Sierra College. They have a program with about 500 vets in it. And the people in that program told me that one of the big problems is exactly what you said, that these students come back, many of them have had traumatic brain injuries, and they just can't wrap their minds around the studying anymore. You know, so the college gives them all kinds of leeway. They give them tutors. They give them extra time to do tests. They, you know, allow them to take the tests home or whatever so, you know, they don't have pressure situations. But I talked to a few of those students who were in explosions. And, they're having a very tough road. And this is not the federal government. This is not the military trying to help them. It's this local community college system.
Thanks for that call, Paul. Is there a difference? There are two things I want to get to before the end of the show. We're running out of time, as usual. And the callers all show up in the last 10 minutes. That's also pretty typical for when I'm on. Is there a gender difference in terms of these injuries?
There is some interesting research that shows, yes, but I don't know enough about it to explain it. Okay. I find, you know, in general, there have been far more men in the military affected by TBIs than women, which probably just reflects, you know, the numbers of each gender and what it is that they do. But one of the most upsetting cases we came across was a woman named Michelle Diarmond, you know, who had master's list in college, you know, college degrees, all kinds of skills. She was a major in Iraq. You know, she rose to a pretty high level. She was in two explosions. You know, same story as we've heard, been, you know, hearing and talking about for the last hour almost. Nobody in the military diagnosed her with a traumatic brain injury. They sent her to Walter Reed for almost 2 years to deal with the neck and back injuries she got in a vehicle accident in Iraq. And they tried to help her with, you know, counseling and stuff for her post-traumatic stress disorder. But nobody picked up on the fact that she had, you know, like all the other people we've been talking about, her brain wasn't working the same way anymore. And she was only diagnosed when she got out of the military. And, you know, she's been struggling at her job. She went back to the same job she had before she went to Iraq. And she, you know, I talked to one of her coworkers who says, we are helping her a lot because she just can't do the job like she used to. Now, she was afraid of going on the air and being identified, because she was afraid she'd be fired. But she called me shortly before the story went on, and she said, you know what? All my supervisors say they're 100% behind me and that I have nothing to worry about, which gives me chills,
wow,
you know, to say.
Well, that's a piece of good news. We've got about a minute or so left. What needs to happen to fix this problem?
I think members of Congress need to say to the military, you must take this seriously. And I think there need to be top leaders of the military who are not so removed from the reality on the ground. You know, they live in a rarefied world. it's yes, sir, no, sir. And there are some generals of the Pentagon who really do take this seriously, I think, but they just simply do not understand what's going on at the ground level enough. They don't have, you know, people who tell them bad news enough to really realize it's a horrible problem. And they think that things are a lot better than they really are. So they need to get more in touch with reality.
Well, that may be asking a lot. I'm not sure. Daniel Zwerdling, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I really appreciate your time this morning, and keep covering this story because this is hugely important.
Well, John, thanks so much for focusing on it.
Daniel Zwerdling, National Desk Correspondent for NPR, has been my guest. Chrissy Pease gets to go to the head of the class for booking Daniel Zwerdling this morning. Thanks to Dave Potratz and Rhonda Fanning for on-air production today. If you missed a part of this program and would like to hear the full interview, you can go to our website, WPR.org, and listen to the whole thing all over again. And you can, you just go to the Kathleen Dunn page on the WPR website, and you'll be able to find it easily. Coming up next, Eating with the Enemy, Barbecue Diplomacy. You won't want to miss that. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR.